fellow podcast listener, and welcome to the Pop Culture Pub. I am your host. My name is Chris Lockhart, and I know on my introduction little blurb there on the feed, I had mentioned that our first episode would be about Avengers Infinity War / Endgame discussion, and that episode two would be annoying things of pop culture, and that I was going to have some podcasting friends on those episodes. They are still coming. We are going to be recording those episodes in a couple weeks for release, and you know, probably soon thereafter. But for now, I am recording a couple of test episodes, just because I, you know, when I left podcasting, I got rid of a lot of my programs. A lot of my editing programs, a lot of my, you know, all that kind of stuff. I've since bought a new microphone, and I had to make, you know, because it's a new podcast, I had to make new bumpers and all that kind of stuff. So this episode and the next one are basically test episodes, test pilots, if you will, of what's to come. So I'm flying solo on these episodes, so it's just me yammering on. So, you know, on occasion, I will be doing some standalone segment episodes. One's called Chris's Soapbox, which this episode will be one of those episodes. And then the next one is Chris Reviews. And I have a few movies I want to review, and that'll be on the next episode. So for this episode, as I said, this is Chris's Soapbox. And I am talking about the state of Star Trek.
Space, a final frontier.
Now, first and foremost, I am a lifelong Star Trek fan. You know, as far as I can remember, I've always enjoyed Star Trek. Like, I remember watching it, like, I live in Canada, so I remember watching it on the CBC Saturday afternoons. I remember watching it with my dad, which is kind of ironic because my dad is not a Star Trek fan, but for whatever reason, during that time, I guess he was feeling nostalgic for old television or something. And plus, it was, you know, they would air Star Trek prior to Hockey Night in Canada, and my dad is a huge hockey fan. As much as I am a nerd or a geek about Star Trek and that kind of stuff, my dad's a geek and nerd about sports, especially hockey in particular. Hockey is what Star Trek is to me. Like, Star Trek is my number. For my dad, hockey is what Star Trek is to me. That's what I was trying to say. Star Trek for me is my favorite property. It's my favorite pop culture, you know, what, you know, whatever you want to call it, property, I guess. I've been a fan all my life. I remember, you know, watching the original series. I remember watching the movies on CTV. Because you got to remember, kids, this, like, this is predating even before my family had a VCR. So I had to watch these live and so on. And then when my parents finally invested in a VCR, I was able to record episodes and so on and so forth, and the rest is history. That being said, I'm the type of person, if something's good, I will sing its praises. I will be its champion. I will be its cheerleader. But when something's bad, I'm not going to hold back. I'm not just going to shrug my shoulders and say, oh, that's pretty good. Or, you know, it's Star Trek, so it's okay. No. If something's good, it's good. If it's bad, it's bad. Doesn't matter what it is. Whether it's Star Trek, whether it's, you know, I'm a huge fan of the band Queen. If it's a Queen song or an AC/DC song, another band I also thoroughly enjoy. And it's bad, I'm not going to like it. You know, it doesn't matter. If, you know, I'm a big comic book fan, so if Marvel Comics is putting out a comic book which is crap, I will call it out for that. I will not, you know, make excuses. I will not apologize. You know, I call a spade, right? That being said, you know, I do consider myself a lifelong Star Trek fan, but I have never been, like I said, a blind loyalist to Star Trek. When things are bad, I leave. I drop off. The first time this occurred was season 3 of Star Trek Voyager. You know, like, because, I mean, if you go back and you really look at the first two seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation, they are really not very good. There is really only probably, you know, out of those, you know, 52 episodes that they did in those two seasons, so there's probably only 10 episodes that are actually good. The rest, for the most part, are shit. And I mean, it's not, you know, completely their fault. I mean, I don't blame the actors. I don't blame, you know, anyone other than, you know, the creative forces behind the scenes. Because I know there was a lot of turmoil in the writer's room for the first two seasons of Star Trek Next Generation. Actually, William Shatner did a documentary about this. I forget what he called it. Something like Crisis in the Writer's Room or something. And it was actually kind of a neat documentary. And they've talked about this on the Star Trek Next Generation Blu-ray special features that Rob Burnett did, where he actually sat down with a lot of the writers and had a conversation. No, it was Seth MacFarlane that sat down with the writers, but Rob Burnett and his crew produced it. So there was a lot of turmoil in those first couple seasons, and it wasn't very good. That being said, with Star Trek Voyager, the first couple seasons were not good either, but I stayed on board and I waited it out, thinking, okay, this is going to get better. You know, Next Generation, you know, it took the first two seasons, and you know, it wasn't until the third year that they finally found their legs and finally, you know, started becoming what they're known for, you know, good quality television. But halfway through, you know, third season Star Trek Voyager, it still wasn't happening for me. So I gave up. You know, I jumped ship. It was time to go. And I make no apologies for that. And I don't regret that at all. You know, I've since went back and like, I remember when 7 and 9 came on, you know, like that was, you know, made the cover of TV Guide, and there was all this talk, you know, that they're bringing the Borg into Voyager, and it's gotten so much better. And I watched some episodes, and I will admit, the Year of Hell two-parter, I think, is probably one of the finest two-parters Star Trek has ever done, even though it had a stupid ending. You know, one of those endings where everything, you know, resets itself, and it never really happened. That was my biggest complaint about the Next Generation finale. I know a lot of people like it, but I've always not liked it, because it never really happened. You know, nothing that Picard and the crew did in that episode mattered, because it all reset itself, and the only one that remembers any of it is Picard and Q, which I kind of felt was a cheat. You know, like, they should have went out in a blaze of glory on their final episode, and they kind of did up until the point where everything resets and nobody knows what happened. But yeah, so anyway, getting back to Voyager, you know, the Year of Hell two-parter was great. I love Kurtwood Smith. But other than that, you know, I dropped off, and I've checked in a couple times over the years, and while it was still on the air, and you know, I never really got back to it. And it was the same with Star Trek Enterprise at first it was just called Enterprise for the first two seasons, and then they realized that they screwed up by not, you know, putting the Star Trek brand on it, so then it was renamed Star Trek Enterprise with Season 3. A lot of people don't remember that, but that's what happened. And I checked out again in the third season when they introduced the whole Zindi war angle. Because, you know, the whole time I'm thinking, you know, one of my biggest complaints about Star Trek Enterprise, and we're going back to 2001, when the premise was first introduced in the magazines, because, you know, I didn't have the internet back then, so I had no idea other than what I read in magazines like Starlog and Cinescape, those type of magazines. You know, this new Star Trek series was going to be a prequel, that this, you know, Captain Archer is who Captain Kirk read about when he was growing up. You know, this is 100 years before Kirk and Spock and McCoy, and this is about the first Starship Enterprise. And I remember scratching my head thinking, the first Starship Enterprise? If that's the case, why was it never mentioned before? You know, like, that's what I hate about prequels. And, I mean, say what you will about the George Lucas Star Wars prequels. You know, people say, oh, they suck, you know, and this and that. You know, sure, you know, George Lucas made some not great choices from a fan perspective, but you know what? That was his vision. That's what he had planned right from day one, and he executed what he wanted to do. You know, like those prequels, that was all the backstory of Star Wars. He knew about the, you know, the lava and, you know, the cutting off of the legs and, you know, you were my brother, Anakin, and all that. He knew all of that back before he even made the original Star Wars movies. So for, you know, us to criticize him and say, well, they suck. Well, guess what? You know, that was George Lucas's vision, and he executed them to his best ability, meaning that he wrote those movies, those prequels, he directed them, he made them the way he envisioned them. So you can't fault the guy, you know, like he actually probably did prequels better than anyone ever has, because they were part of the original design, whereas Star Trek Enterprise was not. You know, like, this was not, you know, they did not base that series on notes that Gene Roddenberry left or anything like that. It's, you know, they decided to do a prequel series. And right from the start, I knew it was going to cause problems, because I knew there was going to be continuity errors, even though they had people there. You know, they had, I believe, Michael and Denise Okuda worked on that series, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe they didn't, but I'm pretty sure they did. They wrote the Star Trek Encyclopedia. They wrote the Star Trek chronology. You had the experts on the Star Trek timeline working for you, and you didn't use them. Like, that just blows my mind that happened. You know, and that Enterprise ended up with all these terrible continuity errors, things that just didn't make sense. And, you know, and that being said, you know, like when the whole Zindi War thing angle was meant, you know, began, I checked out. I was like, this is dumb. You know, like, this was never mentioned. This is, you know, like, I'm sorry. You know, continuity is very important to some fans, myself included, and Enterprise just kind of shit on continuity at the time. But again, like Voyager, I went back in season 4, because I was hearing good things, and they actually did a really good job. And actually, they, in their own way, was trying to repair some of the continuity issues that they had created from the first two seasons. And I thought they did a good job. And it was a shame that the show got canceled. But unfortunately, I think at that time, you know, in 2005, people, like, especially the general public, were just tired of Star Trek. You know, it was just too much. It was kind of the end of Law and, like, when Law and Order ended after, like, 20 years or 21 years or whatever it was. It was a shame. Law and Order was a great TV show. Even in the last seasons. I loved the last seasons. But, you know, it just, people were tuning out because it's like, oh, eye roll, another Law and Order. You know, why don't they put that to bed? And unfortunately, that's what happened with Star Trek. You know, the general public, you know, they just weren't attracting new viewers, and some of the established viewers were checking out because there was, you know, some fatigue, you know, with all this Star Trek. And I know that, you know, that was a Paramount thing. You know, like, I really think after Voyager, they should have waited a year or two before launching a new series instead of ending Voyager May 2001 and then having Enterprise take place September 2001. I think it was just too soon. So now, you know, I'm not talking about the J.J. Abrams films. For this episode in particular, I'm talking about Star Trek Discovery. Because again, you know, fast forward to, you know, what was it, late fall 2017 when Star Trek Discovery finally came to TV. And again, when they announced it was going to be yet another prequel series, it was going to take place 10 years this time before Kirk and Spock, I knew there was going to be problems. You know, like, why? Why go back in time? Like, why not have this take place after Star Trek Voyager, you know, like, after, you know, in the future, like, have it take place in the 25th century or something, like, you know, have there be, you know, a bit of a time jump, you know, and then you could integrate, you know, some of the actors or some of the characters from previous, you know, whether it be Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, or Voyager, you could have them, you know, do guest stars. I think that might have helped a little bit, to, you know, bring old fans back and bring new fans in. But they didn't. They went with the prequel route, and in my opinion, that was just a mistake. You know, like, again, I knew there was going to be continuity issues, and right off the bat, there was continuity issues. It's like right from the beginning. You know, when they introduced these Klingons, you know, like they're like right away, like Deep Space Nine did a really good job of, you know, showing us Klingon culture and Klingon society. It began with TNG, and then it was continued on into Deep Space Nine, and there was a little glimpse of it in Voyager as well with B'Elanna Torres. But, you know, like, with the Klingons being featured so prominently, you know, during the brief Klingon Federation War that took place in Season 5 of Deep Space Nine, and then, of course, the Dominion War, you know, we saw a lot of Klingon episodes. Like, we saw them, you know, with the lawn hair and the chants and the singing in Klingon language. We heard a lot of the Klingon language, which was first introduced in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. You know, like, so we know how Klingons talk, and then Star Trek Discovery comes along, and Klingons are bald for some reason, and they look a little bit different, and they talk really slow. Like, they, you know, and they're enunciating and talking with the back of their throats, and they're, you know, they're using the Klingon language that's been established, but they're not talking like Klingons. Like, they're, you know, they're talking very slowly and drawn out, and like I said, with the back of their throats, and it was off. It and they had to use subtitles, and it just didn't work. But for some fans, they loved it. I mean, like I said, I really think they're, like, for me, as I said, I will not blindly follow Star Trek or anything if I don't think it's good. Whereas I think a lot of Star Trek fans will, you know, like, they will, doesn't, as long as it's got the Star Trek name on it and the Star Trek logo, they're on board and they love it no matter what. And it's unfortunate because, you know, as long as, well, it's a double-edged sword. It's unfortunate and it's a good thing. It's unfortunate because, you know, the writers and creators will continue putting out a mediocre product if they think people are liking it. They won't make changes because they think that they're doing a good job. But on the other hand, you know, it's a good thing because if Star Trek is doing good, then, you know, there is a chance that there will be other Star Trek brought along later on that will also be good, you know. And I am, like, it was announced last year that they were going to be doing a Captain Picard series, and that it was going to take place, you know, within, you know, the however many years it's been since Star Trek Nemesis. You know, like, they're not going to say, oh, this is 10 years later. No, this is, well, Star Trek Nemesis would have been 2002, so this is 17 years after that, with Patrick Stewart playing Captain Picard. I like that. I like that idea. So, you know, like, honestly, that probably wouldn't have been possible without Star Trek Discovery. That wouldn't have been possible without, you know, the fans tuning in and raving about Star Trek Discovery. So, like I said, it's a double-edged sword. So, in a way, I'm getting what I wanted in the end, hopefully. I don't want to speak too highly of it because I haven't seen it yet, but I know if Patrick Stewart's involved, you know, chances are it's going to be good. But at the same time, you know, you get a mediocre, in my opinion, a mediocre product, that is Star Trek Discovery. And I know, you know, a lot of fans aren't going to be happy when I say that. Some are. Some, I know there are people that do agree with me. You know, Star Trek Discovery has a lot of issues. But like I said, there's a lot of blindly loyal fans out there that will argue and berate you if you say anything bad about Star Trek Discovery, which is unfortunate. Because as I said, getting back to talking about Discovery specifically, the continuity issues I was having a problem with. You know, the whole spore drive thing, I was having an issue with. The fact that, you know, this is supposed to take place 10 years prior to Kirk, but yet the Discovery looks more advanced than the Enterprise E did on Star Trek Nemesis. You know, like, say what you will about The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and Voyager, and even Enterprise to an extent. You know, they did their best to, you know, keep continuity going. Even you know, Enterprise in its own way, in some ways they didn't. But, you know, Next Generation, you know, always paid homage to, you know, the original series whenever it was referenced or talked about. You know, there's the episode, of course, Relics, where Scotty goes back to, or goes to the holodeck on the Enterprise D to go to the original bridge of the original Enterprise, and they recreated, you know, the Enterprise bridge from Star Trek, the original series. So they, on Next Generation, said, that was the bridge. Like, you know, it wasn't altered. It wasn't made to look a little bit more modern. You know, they could have even went back and recreated the bridge from the movie or the movies, but they didn't. They went and they actually recreated the original 60s bridge and said, yes, this is continuity. This is what happened, and we're not ignoring it. So, you know, like, I give them a lot of credit for that. I mean, there were some times continuity was ignored in TNG, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and, of course, Enterprise. But, you know, I think a lot of it was they didn't realize that they were ignoring continuity. They didn't realize that, you know, things had happened. You know, like, for example, is, you know, like, on Star Trek, the movie Star Trek Insurrection, you know, when Riker kisses Troy and then she, like, pushes him away and laughs and says, I've never kissed you with a beard before. And it's like, huh? Scratching your head. You know, how many times, you know, at least probably 4 or 5 times on the TNG series they kissed, you know? And he had a beard. And then, you know, there's a whole Thomas Riker thing, you know, where Troy was, you know, possibly running away with him in that episode. So, you know, they kind of, you know, not, I wouldn't say ignored their own continuity, but they, you know, made mistakes. And, I mean, it happens on Star Trek. But Star Trek Discovery, you know, they had the advantage of, you know, so many years had passed since Star Trek Enterprise ended that they had time. They had time to go back and rewatch and know, okay, we can do this, but we can't do that because that was done here and this was done there. And if the creators had said right from the get-go, okay, guys, this is its own thing, you know, this is not in continuity, we're you know, starting from scratch here, you know, this is its own entity, this is its own series, I would have been okay, good, you know, then you can ignore what's happened before. You can go places that they've gone before. You can, you know, reinvent the wheel, as it were. But they specifically made a point of saying, this is continuity. You know, we're not gonna undermine anything that's already been done. You know, this fits in with all the other Star Trek series that came before and all the movies, except for the J.J. Abrams films, which are take place in their own timeline, which I thought was a brilliant move on J.J. Abrams' part. I'll give him credit for that because, you know, they could do things and it didn't matter. It wouldn't change anything that happened with anything that took place in the TV shows or the movies previously. But Star Trek Discovery said, no, we're in that continuity. We are going to honor and respect what's happened before, and our show's going to fit in with that. And it didn't. They totally did not create, they did not follow continuity, they did not honor what happened before, they did their own thing, and I wish they would have just done that from the beginning and said, listen, this is a reboot, it's its own entity, deal with it. You know, and that's the way it should have been. It, you know, it really should have been like that. Had it been like that, I wouldn't have been as critical about it. I mean, I wouldn't have been happy with it. You know, I really think Discovery is lacking in a lot of ways, it's lacking the feel of Star Trek. It, to me, Star Trek Discovery feels like a Star Wars show, you know, especially like most recently they had the, the first episode of the second season, that whole thing with them flying those little pod things through the asteroids and all that kind of stuff was very reminiscent of the Millennium Falcon, you know, avoiding the TIE fighters in the asteroid field and from Star Wars Episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back. So to me, Star Trek, I've said Star Trek Discovery is an awesome Star Wars show, but not an awesome Star Trek show. And of course that's, you know, unfortunately upset some people, but to me, that's the way I see it. That's the truth. And there are some people that would argue and say, well, you know, because the truth of the matter is technology to do those, you know, high-tech special effects just didn't exist back in the 60s, and it was emerging technology in the 80s and 90s, and really didn't gain traction until like 95. So like with even, you know, the original series, of course, and then with Next Generation, for them to do like a big space battle, for them to do, you know, a ship flying through an asteroid field and stuff like that, it would cost a fortune. And they were doing a television series on a television budget, and they were very limited on time and money. So that's why on TNG and the original series, there's a lot of talking. You know, they talk a lot, and it's more of a cerebral experience, because things are left to your imagination. You know, like the Earth-Romulan War was mentioned, but it wasn't seen. Next Generation, the only times they ever really had big space battles was the last 5 minutes of the episode Yesterday's Enterprise, 5 minutes of Best of Both Worlds Part 2, and then maybe 2 or 3 minutes from the finale, and that was it. Like, there was really no big space battles in Star Trek Next Generation, but they didn't need it. You know, like, the writers had to work a little bit harder to convey the drama, and, you know, with limited action, you know, and they did it, and they sold it. When, you know, and you had amazing actors, you know, doing amazing work. But now, as technology has grown, like I said, like if you go back and rewatch Star Trek, and you'll notice it's not until season 4 of Deep Space Nine, which was around 1995, when you started seeing these big holy crap action sequences, you know, and that all started with the Way of the Warrior TV movie or 2-part episode, however you watch it, the premiere of season 4 of Deep Space Nine. And that's when they really embraced the CGI. That's when that technology became viable. You could do these big action sequences on a television budget, you know, because the CG, you know, the computer generated special effects, finally caught up with writers' imaginations. Unfortunately, that didn't really exist with Next Generation or the original series. But Deep Space Nine, Season 4 forward, and Voyager and Enterprise, they all benefited from this, you know, this new technology. The writers were able to do battles, were able to, show things they wouldn't have been able to show before. You know, like one prime example is the episode, if you go back and watch TNG season 4, the episode, I can't remember the name of the episode, it's the one with O'Brien's former captain, he's going after Cardassians. It's the first episode where they introduce the Cardassians, and his ship, the Phoenix, is operating in Cardassian space and destroying Cardassian ships and so on and so forth. On that episode, you saw, like, you know, when Picard and Gul Masset are watching, you know, the battle unfold on the bridge, they're just watching the, you know, the computer-generated graphics, you know, because they're so far away, they can't actually see the battle. So the writers, they watched it on the view screen, and basically it's like a poor man's computer-generated video game is essentially kind of what they were watching. But, you know, it was a way for them to show the battle without actually showing it. And the reason why they did that was because they didn't have the budget, the time, and the technology to really show a battle. Like, if they had had the CGI technology that they had in 95, they probably would have shown Captain Maxwell and the crew of the Phoenix engaging a Cardassian ship and destroying it. They probably would have shown that on that episode. But as I said, you know, like, that didn't exist during that time, and they had to find a way around it, so that's what they did. You just saw the computer screen. You didn't actually see anything. But as I said, you know, it in its own way, it encouraged the writers to think outside the box. It encouraged them to write in a way where, you know, they couldn't just, you know, have two pages in the script where, you know, this battle and this ship's destroyed and that ship's destroyed, and, you know, they couldn't do that. They actually had to write, and they had to write for the actors, and the actors had to act in a way to make, you know, the action you didn't see believable. So, you know, some would argue and say, you know, like, that was real television. That was, you know, like, they did the best with what they had. You know, one comparison would be, like, the music industry. Like, nowadays, you know, anyone can sing a song as long as they have auto-tune. You know, anyone can be their own one-man band as long as they have a computer program that, you know, can synthesize, you know, all this music, right? You know, back in the 70s and the 80s, that didn't really exist. Like, you actually had to know how to play a guitar. You actually had to learn to play the piano. You actually had to sing. You know, there wasn't a device that made you sound good. You had to actually work on your own voice. You know, it's a similar comparison with the, you know, CGI and all that in, you know, science fiction television. But anyway, getting back to, you know, the main topic, and that is the state of Star Trek. Again, you know, I will never say I'm a huge fan of Star Trek Discovery. I do hope it gets better. In my own mind, I know this might be OCD or whatever you want to call it, but as I said, the producers and the writers said that this show would take place in continuity of the original series and TNG and Deep Space Nine, you know, and it would respect what came before. And as I said, I pointed out examples of where it just isn't. That's not a thing. Despite their assurances that this is taking place in continuity, I view this series as its own continuity. I think of it outside of its own... It's its own entity. It's its own thing. It's its own timeline, however you want to call it. And in that way, I'm able to enjoy it a lot more. You know, I'm not dissecting each episode and saying, well, they can't do that because, you know, that's already been established. That doesn't happen yet. You know, like the fact that... you know, they have, you know, basically like holodeck-like technology. Like, back in 1987, the holodeck was like a giant leap forward, not just in the Star Trek universe, but in television universe. The fact that they had this room where they could, create whatever environment, they could do whatever they want there, and they could do all the stuff. You know, like, that was a new concept. It was new technology, as I said, on the show, and... In reality. But again, the Discovery is a prequel, but yet they have those technologies. And it just kind of, you know, just shake my head and say, like, you know, you guys are saying this is supposed to be continuity, but it's not continuity. So I view this show as being its own thing, its own entity, separate from the rest of Star Trek. And in that way, I'm able to enjoy it a little bit more. I'm still not 100% on board. I mean, there are some good things about this show, don't get me wrong. Like, I love Mary Wiseman as Cadet Tilly. I love that character. I really like Doug Jones as Saru. I really like him. The character Michael Burnham, I'm not really sold on, to be honest with you. I know a lot of people like that character. You know, Shaniqua Martin Green is a fine actress. I've got nothing against her. I watched her on The Walking Dead, and I didn't mind her there either. But she's just not carrying the show. I really don't like the fact that this isn't an ensemble show. Like, I like the fact that I don't know any of the other Bridge characters is kind of disheartening for me. Like, I know on the season 2 premiere, like, Captain Pike goes around the bridge and everyone says their name and, you know, and they introduce themselves. I don't remember any of those names, you know, honestly. Like, their characters are one-dimensional, and, you know, like, there's the red-headed helmsman chick that's got, like, a metal piece on her head, and she's got two different colored eyes. Then there's the robot chick. Then there's the black con woman officer. I really don't know anybody. Like, and to me it's unfortunate because, like, on, you know, the original, and that's the thing, people, you know, will say, well, you know, this show is about Michael Burnham. It's not about, you know, an ensemble. That is true, you know, and this is a new thing for Trek. And I say to them, no, it's not a new thing for Trek. If you go back and watch Star Trek, the original series, that show originally, the original concept is it was a Captain Kirk show. Especially if you watch the first half of the first season, William Shatner is the star of that show. There's no doubt about it. He is the center of that show in the way that Michael Burnham is the center of this show. But as the series progressed, you know, with the popularity of Leonard Nimoy and Mr. Spock, he became, you know, also center of that show. And then eventually DeForest Kelly, you know, they became, you know, the trifecta of that show. But they also had a strong supporting cast that, you know, each one of them got a little bit of spotlight every so often. Like Uhura, Scott, you know, like Wolf in the Fold was a Scotty episode. You know, Chekhov and Sulu, they all got their times to shine. Like, they were, you know, and they were there, and they all had lines, and they were, it became an ensemble show. And Next Generation right out of the gate was an ensemble show. You know, it wasn't about Picard specifically. He was the lead, but I mean, you know, they had Riker episodes, they had LaForge episodes, they had Wesley Crusher episodes, they had Worf episodes, Data episodes, Troy had episodes, Dr. Crusher had, you know, some really terrible episodes, especially the one with her grandmother dating a ghost, and, you know, man, that was terrible. That was some really bad episodes. But anyway, you know, I really don't think Shaniqua Martin Green, you know, is carrying the show. I really don't think, you know, she is. Now they have Anson Mount on the show as Captain Pike, and I hope he stays for a while, because I really like him as an actor. I'm a huge fan of the series Hell on Wheels, which he was the star of, and I just think he's a wonderful actor, and I think he's great as Captain Pike. It's funny, like, if you see a side-by-side comparison of Jeffrey Hunter, the original Captain Pike, and Anson Mount as Captain Pike, they look very similar. Like, the, you know, the casting was absolutely brilliant, and he's a great actor. So I'm hoping Captain Pike stays with the show. And as I said, you know, I really, like, I view this show as being its own continuity and not tied in with any Star Trek series. And I'm hoping the producers and the writers will just finally say, okay, we're doing our own thing here now. And I would love to see Anson Mount just stay on Discovery as its permanent captain. You know, I think that would be great. But we'll see what happens. You know, maybe it might happen. But, you know, like, they really hit the lottery, I think, with that actor. He definitely has the chops to carry a show. No offense to Shaniqua Martin Green or anything like that. I'm not anti woman. I'm not anti, you know, minority. I'm not anything. You know, like, you know, if you know, if you're a great actor and you've got great material to work with, it doesn't matter what who you are. It doesn't matter what sex you are. It doesn't matter your race. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to me. You know, as long as the material's good, the acting's good, you know, I will watch anybody take the lead if they have that going for them. And unfortunately, she just doesn't. And I'm not saying she's a bad actress. I just don't think they're giving her good material to work with. And I really don't think she... Again, I'm not saying she's a bad actress. I just don't think she's got the chops to carry a show on her own. I really don't. Like, honestly, like, if... And this is a test right here. If they were to take this character and have her go off somewhere else, and we, the viewers, had to follow her to a new environment, like let's say she was transferred to a star base, and, you know, the Discovery was left behind, none of the characters came with her, she went on her own, the series, you know, moves to the star base, it's just her and the new actors around her. If the new actors couldn't pull it off, would you continue watching it? I know I wouldn't, because, like I said, I like Mary Wiseman as Tilly. I like Doug Jones as Saru. I like Anson Mount as Pike. They all work together well as an ensemble. Like, she works good as an ensemble. As a lead, not so much. There's no way I would follow her if they did that. But, again, you know, just my opinion. But then, again, there's also this test coming later this year with Patrick Stewart in the Captain Picard series. He is a great actor. He is somebody that I would follow no matter what. Like, this new series, if they don't have any Next Generation guest stars on it, I'm fine with it. As long as they got good actors to act off Patrick Stewart, that's fine with me. Patrick Stewart is such a good actor that he has done a one-man production of A Christmas Carol, the Charles Dickens play, or whatever you want to call it, Scrooge or whatever, A Christmas Carol. He can do a one-man show of the Christmas Carol where he plays all the characters himself, and people love it because he is that good of an actor that you can watch him on his own. And he sells it. Shaniqua Martin Green isn't that good of an actor. She can't do that. I don't think anyone would watch a one woman show with her. And that's just the way it is. You know, it's like you know, the movie Castaway. If Tom Hanks wasn't as good an actor as he is, that movie would have bombed, because a good, you know, half of that movie. I want to say half of that movie, he's acting to himself. He's alone on an island talking to a volleyball, you know, talking to himself. And that movie is memorable. That movie is considered, you know, good. It's considered a classic by some. Some might say not. But it's because he is such a good actor that people are willing to watch it and believe. You know, he sells it. Patrick Stewart sells it. You know, so that's why I have a lot of faith in this new Captain Picard series coming out. I think it's going to be good. You know, based on Patrick Stewart as an actor. But unfortunately, like I said, Shaniqua Martin Green, just, I don't know. They really, like, I really hope they push Discovery into more of an ensemble show. I would like to see an episode about Saru's backstory. I want to see a Cadet Tilly episode. I want to learn more about Captain Pike, because, I mean, really, we don't know a lot about him. Other than what will happen to him if they follow continuity and he's, you know, ends up getting burnt and trapped in a wheelchair, you know, and then he ends up going to Talos 4. Like, if that happens, that's... I mean, other than that, we really don't know a lot about this guy. So I would like to learn his backstory. I'd like to... Who knows? Maybe he's got... Like, maybe that is one way that, you know, they can get around the continuity issue. Maybe Captain Christopher Pike has a twin brother. You know, maybe Thomas Pike, you know, and Anson Mount could stay on Discovery while Captain Pike goes off and does his own thing in continuity. I don't know. There's, you know, it's science fiction. There's lots of potential there. But anyway, the state of Star Trek, you know, it. I'm glad it's back on television. I'm glad that fans are liking it. But I've gone on record and I've said before that Discovery just isn't my cup of tea. I'm hoping it gets better with season two. As I said, Anson Mount was a great addition. I'm really, you know, like the first episode, very Star Wars-ish of season two. You know, very reminiscent of Star Wars. I wish they would go back and just be more reminiscent of Star Trek. And as I said, I'm very hopeful for the Captain Picard series coming out in later this year, 2019. So anyway, that is my ramblings about the state of Star Trek. My name is Chris Lockhart, and this is the Pop Culture Pub podcast, and we will see you again in the not-too-distant future.